The Progressive Commentary Hour with Gary Null, Mondays at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. I will be sharing commentaries from other individuals who you would not normally hear on either the left or the right, conservative or liberal media, but they have a home here. We are progressive, meaning we're looking for solutions and honest at what is the cause of our dilemmas. Today, I'll be starting with Professor Andrew Gavin Marshall from Global Research, Bilderberg, the Rockefeller World Order and the High Priests of Globalization. Why is this important? Because historically, those who have said the bankers are behind many of our problems, they've attached words such as Zionist, making it immediately discredited as being anti-Semitic. These are just the rantings of some loon who has no background in legitimacy, and therefore swept aside. Or you have those who believe that all the problems in the world are due to the group of bankers without giving us the specific details, vague generalities. I wanted to be very specific and give you a very scholarly examination of who really are behind these foundations, what purpose do they serve, and how does this impact us. Then from Thomas Naylor, what are you going to do about the empire? Now, who is Thomas Naylor? He is a professor emeritus of economics at Duke University. He is also the founder of the Second Vermont Republic. He is a person who has a lot to say, and I'll be expounding with my own ideas on that. And then, time permitting, the New York Times' Favor and Fear by Robert Perry from Op-Ed News. Also, Empire or Republic, How the Empire Destroys Its Own People from Joplin, Missouri to Kabul, Afghanistan by Professor James Petras from Global Research. We have a lot of important topics. Let us begin. The Bilderberg Group, formed in 1954, was founded in the Netherlands as a secret meeting held once a year, drawing roughly 130 of the political, financial, military, academic, media elites from North America and Western Europe. It was labeled as an informal network of influential people who could consult each other privately and confidentially. Now, regular participants include the CEOs or chairmen of some of the largest corporations in the world, oil companies like Dutch Royal Shell, British Petroleum, Total SA, as well as various ministers and central bankers of the world. The Bilderberg Group acts as a secretive global think tank with an original intent to, according to their own statements, to link governments and economies in Europe and North America amid the Cold War. Now, in and of itself, it's not illegal, it's not immoral, not unethical, it's just a group of people who feel that they want to meet with some other people who are equally successful, equally powerful. We have that all the time in our society. People want to be with people at their own status level, in their own class. So thus far, nothing that I would be concerned about. In the early 1950s, top European elites, meaning the most successful in their fields, work with selective American elites to form the Bilderberg Group in an effort to bring together the most influential people from both sides of the Atlantic to advance the cause of globalism. Now, the list of attendees were the usual suspects: top politicians, international business people, bankers, lenders, leaders of think tanks and foundations, top academics and university leaders, diplomats, media moguls, military officials. And Bilderberg also included several heads of states and monarchs, as well as some senior intelligence officials, including top officials of the CIA, which was the main financier for the first meeting in 1954. The European founders of the Bilderberg Group included Joseph Rettinger and Prince Bernard of the Netherlands. and Prince Bernard had, incidentally, been a member of the Nazi Party until 1934, 3 years prior to his marrying the Dutch Queen Juliana, and also work for the German industrial giant IG Farben, the maker of Xylocon B, the gas used in concentration camps. On the American side, those were most prominent in the formation of the Bilderberg Group were David Rockefeller, Dean Rusk, a top official with the Council on Foreign Relations, who was then the head of the Rockefeller Foundation, Joseph Johnson, another Council on Foreign Relations leader who was also head of the Carnegie Endowment, John J. McCloy, a top Council on Foreign Relations leader who became chairman of Chase Manhattan Bank in 1953 and was also chairman of the board of the Ford Foundation. Now we're beginning to see something here. We're beginning to see that three major American foundations, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Carnegie Foundation, the Ford Foundation, so pivotal in the origins of the Bilderberg Group, is not a mere coincidence. We see people with interlocking relationships. They're on one board and serve on another. The foundations have, since their founding at the beginning of the 20th century, been the central institutions in constructing consensus among elites and creating consent to power. They are, in short, the engines of social engineering, both for elite circles specifically and society as a whole. More generally, as Professor of Education Robert Arnoff wrote in his book, Philanthropic and Cultural Imperialism, foundations like Carnegie, Rockefeller, and Ford have a corrosive influence on a democratic society. They represent relatively unregulated and unaccountable concentrations of power and wealth, which buy talent, promote causes, and in effect establish an agenda of what merits society's attention. They serve as cooling out agencies, delaying and preventing more radical structural change. They help maintain an economic and political order, international in scope, which benefits the ruling class interest of philanthropic individuals and philanthropoids, a system which has worked against the interests of minorities, the working class, and third world indigenous people, unquote. These foundations had been central in promoting the ideology of globalism that laid the groundwork for organizations such as the Council on Foreign Relations and the Bilderberg Group to exist. The Rockefeller Foundation in particular supported several organizations that promoted a liberal internationalist philosophy and the aim, which was to support a foreign policy within a new world order that was to feature the United States as the leading power, a program defined by the Rockefeller Foundation as objective and non-political. Well, the major foundations funded and created not only policy-oriented institutes such as think tanks, but they were also pivotal in the organization and construction of universities and education itself, in particular the study of international relations. The influence of foundations over education in universities and thus knowledge itself is unparalleled. This was what was written in the book on philanthropic and cultural imperialism. Quote, "The power of the foundation is not that of dictating what will be studied. Its power consists in defining professional and intellectual parameters, in determining who will receive support to study what subjects, in what settings. And the foundation's power resides in suggesting certain types of activities it favors and is willing to support. As political theorist and economist Harold Lasky noted, the foundations do not control, simply because, in the direct and simple sense of the word, there is no need for them to do so. They have only to indicate the immediate direction of their minds for the whole university world to discover that it is always meant to gravitate to that angle of the intellectual compass," unquote. Now, what does this mean in lay language? First, let's look at it in a very graphic way today. If you were to go down to Jamaica, a beautiful island, and you would see that most of the people on the island are impoverished. Kingston, the capital, is a hotbed for crime and drugs. When I first visited Jamaica, I could drive from one end to the island, cross back and forth, and find thousands upon thousands of small farms. People were not wealthy by any means, but they were not starving either. Every community had cooperatives, meaning one farmer grew, let's say, sugar beans and snap peas, and another one might have grown okra. Someone else would have grown bananas, and someone else grown peanuts. Everybody grew because the temperature is so good for growing. Lots of rain, nice sun, cooling off in the mountains, in the Blue Mountains at night, and the soil's rich as volcanic soil. So after you grow your crops, like in Minnesota, you grow one crop a year. You better harvest it before the fall frost, or you don't get anything until spring, because the ground gets frozen, snow comes, and it's very inclement weather. But down there, the weather is beautiful 12 months a year, all the time you can grow. So people are growing. I remember going to a farmer's market before it was called a farmer's market. It was called a food exchange. And there would have been 400 or 500 people lined up in a little tiny pole. There would be like four poles with a piece of tin aluminum on it. And they'd be sitting there with whatever they were selling. And someone would come by and say, I want some corn on the cob. And someone would say, okay, I want some potatoes. And they would exchange this with each other. And they knew what one was worth compared to the other. It was not expensive. That's how it was virtually on all the islands. And that's also how it was in many of the countries in Central and South America. People were poor, but they were not starving. Then came globalization. And how did we get globalization? Globalization just didn't come because someone decided to market some genetically engineered seeds in a foreign country. It came through three ways. First, it came through the Carnegie and Ford and Rockefeller Foundation promoting globalization, that it was a good thing, that we could take countries that had poor people and make them more prosperous, feed them better, get rid of their insects and improve their crops and the amount of crops per acre. Hence, on the outside, it looked good. And the Rockefeller Foundation was behind this, but they didn't start in Jamaica. It started in India. So in India, for example, you might have a village of, let's just say for our purposes, 2,000 people. And people had lived in this village their whole lives and their families going back generations. You had anywhere from a small slice of land, a little sliver, to maybe 20, 30 acres. And everybody grew different things, but everybody shared. So if you went into any given person's home, it would look like a health food store. Now, they didn't have junk foods, and they didn't have a lot of convenience foods. They certainly didn't have the junk food restaurants that we have. They had, for example, maybe 100 different types of legumes and beans and lentils and split peas, and they would have these in baskets. So a person would just take what they wanted and cook them, and they all had variety, and they had lots of spices. And just maybe two or three people would just grow all the different spices. For example, if you go in a health food store in the United States and you look for a chili pepper, a cayenne pepper, they give a little spice, a little heat to what you're eating, you'll find one or two varieties. That's it. But in India, they have over 100 different types of peppers with varying degrees of heat and taste. They have multiple types of curry, dozens of curries. Here we have one. You want curry, it all tastes the same. You want hot pepper, it all tastes the same. But in India, a veritable supermarket. So now just imagine that throughout your life, you always have a variety of food. The greater variety of food, the healthier you are. After all, these were foods that were not sprayed. They were all organic, and they were all the time. And there was plenty of it. It's rare to find obese people in India. First, it's not a part of their culture, but secondly, they're always active, lots of physical activity, and they're conscious of diet. In comes Rockefeller Foundation and its think tank and its experts and scientists and says, look, this is all very inefficient. So what we're going to do, we're going to plant a special type of rice. This rice is so good because it's disease resistant, it doesn't need as much water, and you're going to get a higher yield. And because of pressure from the government and the wealthier landowners, they were able to take these people's farms and they were able to put the rice into these areas. But then they found that the rice needed pesticides. Okay, so we're giving you the pesticides to go with this. Then the weeds grew up. Normally those weeds would have been pulled by hand, or they would have had creatures out like a goat or a cow eating the weeds, and so they wouldn't have had a big problem. But now they had weeds, and it's a monocrop. They're not growing 200 different varieties of food that you would have otherwise seen growing. They're growing one item, rice. So now they have to have pesticides and herbicides. Pesticides that kill the little critters, the little insects, and herbicides to kill the weeds. But now the soil isn't being nourished the way it used to be. When you rotate crops in a soil, you disrupt the habit of the insects, so you have lower insect infestation. But if you keep growing the same crop, wheat, corn, cotton, tobacco, whatever it is, year in and year out on the same crop, you're going to destroy the land and you're going to make it more susceptible to insects. So now the soil was drying out. So they brought in artificial fertilizer. Now, of course, before, when you had a little 50-foot by 100-foot lot, or you had an acre, or you had 10 acres, you could harvest that by hand. And after all, no one ever harvested everything all at once. The idea was, well, like what I do now. I show people how to grow lettuce. I might grow 50 different varieties of lettuce. And I don't grow them all at once. I plant them over a period of months. And that way, as they're coming up at different times. And then I never go out and pull a head of lettuce out of the ground. I go out and I'll clip one leaf, two leaves maximum, off each head. What happens is, it grows back. So I might have one head of lettuce that I'm eating from for a year in the ground. And so it creates sustainability. Now, the Indians used to do something similar. When they had gourds coming up and squash coming up and garlic and onions, they wouldn't go and harvest it all at once. They'd take a little bit each day as they needed it. Need some garlic? Go get some garlic. Need some tomatoes? Go pull some tomatoes. But now they had a monocrop, a single crop, so they would harvest it all at once, thousands of acres. Well, you need machines to do that, so in come the machines, and then the machines break down, so in come the spare parts and the service. So now a whole industry of bringing in the Green Revolution. The trouble is, the Green Revolution was a lie. It did not improve the quality of their lives. To the contrary, now people who had been poor but had no problems with food now were poor and starving. So they migrated to the cities. Some people, unfortunately, actually people would sell their daughters into sexual slavery, or their sons into working in brick factories or weaving factories that would really hurt the children. But that's, they needed the money, and unfortunately that was considered not good, but it was something that had been going on for a long time. That's the ugly dark side of globalization they never spoke about. So disruption of people's lives, taking them off their land, giving the best, most fertile land to the massive big farmers, bringing in lots of money for the John Deeres and whoever was making the equipment, the pesticide makers. So all the big players, DuPont, Monsanto, all these companies saw this was a whole new income stream for them. And of course, all the bribes and all the arm twisting of Indian officials. You don't have to twist an arm very far in India before a bribe is asked and a bribe is given. It's a part of the way they do business. But where does that leave the 95% of the population? It leaves them victims. Now let's go back to Jamaica. Once the Green Revolution was manipulated in the media to look like it was this great, wonderful thing that saved the world from hunger, then Bill Clinton, started allowing the farm cartels in the United States, and through official policy, to take their products, subsidized by the government, the taxpayer, into Jamaica and all of the Caribbean. So let's say that you were a farmer that grew potatoes, or someone else who grew onions, or someone else who had a dairy, and you had milk. Now, crates of potatoes were coming in, and every other product that they made in Jamaica, but cheaper than what the Jamaicans could grow it and sell it themselves. Well, how long do you think it's going to take for people to say, would you whiz, if there's two potatoes, one from America that is half the price of the one grown here, I'm going to take the one grown in America because I'm saving money. Over a period of a few years, and it didn't take many years, it literally destroyed the food self-sufficiency of Jamaicans. Then they went into Port-au-Prince. They went into Haiti. They did the same thing. Haitians at one time were under dictatorial rule by Papa Doc Duvalier and the dreaded secret army, Tom McCous, but they grew rice. They grew beans. They were not starving to death until Bill Clinton came in and said, okay, we're going to give you rice cheaper than what you can grow rice yourself. And after all, when you grow rice, it takes a long time to get it. We're going to have rice every month coming, so you never have to worry about running out of rice. And the Jamaicans, do you know how long it takes to grow a potato from a little spud to a full-grown potato? It's going to take you over 100 days. We can have every month new potato shipments. So by using globalization, by subsidizing major farm cartels, we took over the food production and distribution around the world and made people starve. Then in comes the International Monetary Fund. That's the next part of this story. The International Monetary Fund would go to a country that was needing some money and say, we're going to give you $1 billion. But for that $1 billion, we need you to build this road. And $500 million is going to go to build the road from the port, where the ships are, out into the country where there's rubber plantations. And, oh, by the way, you know that nice fertile soil that all those people live on, where they're growing fruits and vegetables and legumes and breadfruits and plantain? Get rid of them. Get them off the land, because it's too good a land. Where are they supposed to live? The sides of mountains. Well, how are they supposed to live there? Every time it rains all the time, they're going to slide right down. They're going to be mudslides. It's going to kill people. Not our problem. Our problem is, it's all about accounting. It's about efficiency. We're giving you a loan that your nation will pay back. How are we supposed to pay it back? Well, now that's going to be tricky. It's called structural adjustments. Now, what this means is this. We want you to adjust how you allocate money and services to your people. You know those free tickets that they can ride anywhere on a bus in your country? Get rid of that. You know where people can retire and get a pension? Well, they could at 55, make that 75. You know that free cooking oil you give all the homes? No more. You know the free electricity? Well, better still, we're going to have a company come in and they're going to take over your electrical company for the whole country, and they'll put in some new power lines, much better service, but now people will pay for the right to have that electricity. Oh, and the water that they get turned on a tap and it comes out and they can take a shower or cook or a drink. I've got a company coming in called Bechtel, and Bechtel, which is a major company, contractor, the president is Caspar Weinbrenner. Oh, and the other president was George Shultz. Well, didn't I mention George Shultz earlier? Yes, same George Shultz. So they're going to privatize water, privatize electricity. They're going to build some roads, but people cannot ride on the roads unless they pay a toll. We want to get them off all that good land, put them on the sides of hills. We don't care where they live as long as they're not taking up that good land. We're going to be working with the wealthiest people in the country to make sure all this gets done so our hands are clean. We're going to be Pontius Pilate in this. You do the killing, you do the bribing, you do the threatening. And by the way, at no time do we want to hear any union people coming in, because we also believe that to help some of our multinational friends, we're going to be opening up some shirt factories and dress factories here. And we're going to have special zones set aside. These are commercial manufacturing zones, trade zones. Now, there's to be no unions, no minimum wage, no environmental protections, and we don't want any arguments. So they're going to be working 14-hour days, and we're going to give them 14 cents an hour. That's it. Now, we've already taken care to make sure our partners there, the wealthiest families and members of the government, are all on our side. We got the media that will black out the story of what's happening to these people. That story won't be told for another 30 years. So we've got a long time to exploit the natural resources here. But once we give this $1 billion, and the guy says, well, how much does actually come into our government? Well, fool, nothing. I mean, we've got to build your roads. You can't build roads. You're idiots. We're going to bring in a French company to build the roads, and then we're going to bring in a German company to do the engineering and construction to make sure that all those plantations, those rubber plantations, are done correctly, from irrigation and extraction and planting and maintenance and disease control. We've got an American company going to take care of your water, a Canadian company going to privatize electricity. So they're the ones who have to be helped. We can't expect these people to come in here and pay all for that themselves. So, but we're going to do this. We're going to see that you get maybe $50 million. And we're going to see that you, which country do you like? You got like France, the Riviera, the Italian Riviera. Now, we can see that you get a villa there in Switzerland and private jet, expensive trips over there where you can go shopping, right? Go shopping, buy all you want. And that's going to stay out of the press. So we'll make it look like you are very benevolent. You're wanting to help your people. You're putting people to work. You're improving their environment. The dictator or the military junta and says, but hold on a second. Isn't this going to cause some social conflict? I mean, how long do you think people go when they get their water and electricity for free and you're going to charge them? When their cooking oil and their gasoline is inexpensive or free and you're going to charge them? These are poor people to begin with, but they're not hostile. You're going to make them poor and hostile. Well, that's why our Secretary of State and our Secretary of the Defense are going to meet with the National Security Director, and we're going to make sure that we have CIA ops here. We're going to make sure that anyone who gives us trouble, they'll be disappeared. So you won't have any union organizers that will succeed. You won't have any problem. We'll disappear, we'll torture, we'll kill a lot of people. Now, we're going to take your military people and we're going to bring up to the United States to School of the Americas. We're going to show them how to torture, kill, and keep anyone from exercising democratic rights. Do we have a deal? Yeah, we got a deal. Are you sure that if there's a problem, I'll get out of the country? Yes. You're sure if there's anything going on, I'm going to continue to have a lifestyle and I'll get all the money I need? Absolutely. We could name you 100 countries that we have done this with. And no one will ever attack us. The New York Times, Washington Post, we've got them. You know, the person who sits on the Times board sits on our board. So you see, by having the foundations and then having the think tanks that are supported by the foundation and then having the scientists and the journalists and the activists and academics who are paid to be affiliated with the think tanks or the foundations, who's going to complain? Where are they going to go to? The moment they open their mouth, we're going to have one of our people who are official people and credible people stand up and say it's all nonsense, and it'll never see the light of day. That's called structural adjustment. That is the heavy hand of globalization. So jump ahead 5 years, 10 years. You have massive poverty in every single African country, South American country, Southeast Asia country. Every single country with the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, two of the most criminal organizations on the planet. Then add in the World Trade Organization, and then their treaties, NAFTA, GATT. Every place that this was done, people have suffered, people have died. People have become imprisoned by a system where they have no capacity for redress. All the while, the multinationals are making out very nicely. And if there's ever a problem, it's oh, those communists or those Marxists or those anarchists, we got to send in more troops and you got to be harder on them. So when you take a look today at 100 million young people demonstrating in the Middle East, when you look at Tunisia and you look at, let's say, Egypt and other countries that are falling, this is not the end of it. This is merely the first stage, because people taking the place of the dictators or kings or rulers are the military, and they're all corporatists, and they're the ones who are the permanent bureaucracy of the United States put in place. Now, you have 100,000 people today demonstrating, and a million people, nearly a million, who stayed away from work in England to protest these austerity cuts. In Greece, you're taking people already were poor because they don't concern themselves when the rich individuals and rich corporations don't pay any taxes, when they do something stupid like buy submarines. Exactly why Greece needed to buy submarines? Well, that's part of the deal. If we're to help you, you've got to help the military-industrial complex. I see. And are members of those people in Bilderberg and Council on Foreign Relations? Oh, yeah. Heavily represented. So in other words, for us to be able to exist and hold power, we have to have a quid pro quo. We have to buy weapons or privatize parts of our society. Yeah. But now you want us to pay back the bankers who created this problem, and we have to pay it back by making people suffer, cutting back social services. Right now, today, in the streets of Greece, you would think you were in a slum in Jamaica. It doesn't look like the great Greece of old, because people are poor, have no place to go, so they're just living on the streets. And now they're protesting, and they're angry. Who are these people? These are mainly young people who are still filled with passion, with some sense of idealism, and some sense of capacity of rage, something we don't have in America. So that's globalization also. Everywhere you look, manipulation of currencies, bailing out banks, secret deals, Enron-like scandals, privatizing everything they can privatize. Oh, by the way, you know those monuments? Throw them in. We're going to have to privatize them. There's some companies or individuals who would like to have a Greek 3,000-year-old monument. He'll make it into a tourist attraction, or he might come over there and build a 30,000-square-foot house for himself. Oh, and all your other national treasuries, throw them into the kitty, because that's what you have to give us back for us to give you any more money. But aren't you like a drug addict? Isn't this like heroin to a drug addict? Yeah, but that's not the way we'll spin it. Do you remember the movie Apocalypse Now, where Charlie Sheen had to go up and kill the Marlon Brando figure? They didn't say, we want you to go and shoot him in the head or cut his throat. They said, eliminate with extreme prejudice. I see. That's kind of a cleaned up, sanitized way of saying, let's kill someone. So that's what globalization is. The major philanthropic foundations created by America's robber baron industrialists and bankers were established not to benefit mankind, as was their stated purpose, but to benefit the bankers and industrialists, the elites, in order to engage in social engineering. And through these banks, these powerful families controlled the global economy. And through think tanks, they manage the political and foreign policy establishments. And through foundations, they engineer society itself according to their own designs and interests. And through these foundations, elites have come to shape the process, the ideas, the institutions of education, thus ensuring their continued power over society through the production and control of knowledge. The educational institutions train further elites for government, economic, science, and other professional environments, such as anything they want in the future, they teach you now. Now, foundations effectively blur boundaries between the public and private sectors, and while simultaneously affecting the separation of such areas in the study of social sciences, this boundary erosion between public and private spheres adds futile elements to our purported democracy. Yet it has not been resisted, protested, or even noted much by political elites from either the left or the right, or even from social scientists. It was Zbigniew Brzezinski, foreign policy strategist and former director of the Council on Foreign Relations, and a Bilderberg member and co-founder with David Rockefeller of the Trilateral Commission, wrote that the blurring of boundaries, quote, serves United States world dominance. And as the imitation of American ways gradually pervades the world, it creates a more congenial setting for the exercise of the direct and seemingly consensual American power. In 1915, a congressional investigation of the power of philanthropic foundations took place, named the Walsh Commission, which warned, quote, the power of wealth could overwhelm democratic culture and politics. The final report of the Walsh Commission, quote, suggested that foundations would be more likely to pursue their own ideology in society than societal objectivity. Well, in this context, we can come to understand the evolution of the Bilderberg Group as an international think tank aimed at constructing consensus and entrenching ideology among the elite. At their first meeting, the Bilderbergs covered the following broad areas, which remain focal points of discussion for successive meetings. They talked about communism in the Soviet Union, dependent areas of people overseas, economic policies and problems, and European immigration and European defense community. Now, nearly every single American participant in the Bilderberg meeting was also a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. And among the most notable members of the Bilderberg Group in its early years were David Rockefeller, Dean Rusk, John J. McCloy, George McKee, George Ball, Walt Whitman Rostow, McGeorge Bundy, Arthur Dean, and Paul Neitz. As political scientist Stephen Gilroy, quote, prominent in the American section were the network of Rockefeller interests. Now, certainly while Rothschild interests have remained in the Bilderberg Group, as evidenced by Edmund de Rothschild having been a member of the steering committee and Franco Bernabei, vice chairman of the Rothschild Group Europe, being a current Sterling Committee member, the Rockefeller interests seem to be most dominant. Not only is David Rockefeller sitting as the single individual of the member advisory group of the steering committee, but close Rockefeller confidants have long served on the steering committee and been affiliated with the organization, such as Sharon Percy Rockefeller, George Ball, a longtime leader of the Council on Foreign Relations, who was Undersecretary of State for Economic Affairs in the Kennedy and Johnson administrations, Henry Kissinger, longtime Rockefeller aide and American imperial strategist, Zygmunt Brzezinski, who co-founded the Trilateral Commission with David Rockefeller, Joseph E. Johnson, former U.S. State Department official and president of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, John J. McCloy, former chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations, superseded by David Rockefeller, and a former trustee of the Rockefeller Foundation, chairman of the Ford Foundation, president of the World Bank, and James Wolfeson, former president of the World Bank and trustee of the Rockefeller Foundation. Now, we've given you the names, and I've shown you the connection between all of them. One current steering committee member who is representative of not only a continuation of Rockefeller interests, but also the continuing influence and role of the major foundations is Jessica Matthews. She is president of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, who had served on the National Security Council under Zygmunt Brzezinski, was a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, at which David Rockefeller remains an honorary chairman, and is a member of the Trilateral Commission, and is a trustee of the Rockefeller Foundation, and also served on the boards of the Brookings Institute, the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, and the Joyce Foundation. Now, Joseph Rettinger, one of the founders of the Bilderberg Group, was also one of the original architects of the European Common Market and a leading intellectual champion of European integration. In 1946, he told the Royal Institute of International Affairs, that's the British counterpart and sister organization, the Council on Foreign Relations, that Europe needed to create a federal union and for European countries to relinquish part of their sovereignty. Rettinger was a founder of the European Movement, a lobbying organization dedicated to creating a federal Europe. And by the way, that's what we have today with the European Union. And what kind of a mess is that? And apart from Rettinger, the founder of the Bilderberg Group and European Movement, another ideological founder of European integration was Jean Monnet, who founded the Action Committee for the United States of Europe, an organization dedicated to promoting European integration, was also a major promoter and first president of the European Coal and Steel Community, the precursor of the European Common Market. Now, declassified documents released in 2001 show that the, quote, the United States intelligence community ran a campaign in the 50s and 60s to build momentum for a united Europe, meaning European Union. It funded and directed the European Federalist Movement. Now, the documents revealed that America was working aggressively behind the scenes to push Britain into the European Union. One memorandum, dated July 26, 1950, gives instructions for a campaign to promote a full-fledged European Parliament. It is signed by General William J. Donovan, head of the American Wartime Office of Strategic Services, precursor to our CIA. Further, quote, Washington's main tool for shaping the European agenda was the American Committee for the United Europe, created in 1948. The chairman was Donovan, ostensibly a private lawyer by then, and the vice chairman was Alan Dulles, the CIA director in the 50s. The board included Walter Bendel Smith, the CIA's first director, and a roster of ex-OSS figures and officials who moved in and out of the CIA. The documents show that this group was financed by the CIA, and their idea was, let's have a European Union, because once you have a European Union, that means everyone has to agree to a single currency, everyone has to agree to the same economic policy. Then you can go in and get each country to agree to different types of financial interests. You can control the banks, you can control the major industries. So we have a whole paper trail. In 1957, 2 years after all, the people were on board. The Treaty of Rome was signed, which created the European Economic Community, also known as the European Community. And over the decades, various other treaties were signed, and more countries joined the European Community. In 1992, there was another treaty, the Maastricht Treaty, which created the European Union and led to the creation of the euro. And the European Constitution, or renamed the Lisbon Treaty, was a move towards creating a European superstate. Well, now you have one European Union, which has enormous power and over 500 million people living in it, and it's an economy which is larger than the United States. So now they had the power of collective thinking, collective financing, collective commerce, but also collective control. Whoever controlled the decisions and money behind the European Union control virtually all the member states. And the Bilderbergs were behind that. All you have to do is look at your history. So we've had leaks coming out of the Bilderberg meetings. For example, the 2011 Bilderberg meeting in Switzerland. The Eurozone is in a major crisis. The Bilderberg members are struggling to keep the House of Glass from shattering to pieces. And one major subject discussed at this year's meeting, according to Bilderberg investigative journalist, what the Bilderberg meeting disclosed, you know, what are we going to do with Greece? Well, now they know what they're doing with Greece and Ireland, but they can't keep this up. Greece will fall. They can't control the people. The people are going to the streets. The Greek government will fall. The Irish government will fall. The Portugal and Spain governments will fall. And when that happens, and when they finally say, enough, we're not going to pay you back, bankers, at the sacrificing of our social services, the people rejoice. Initially, the Bilderberg group will make it look like this is a disaster for the country. How dare you not pay back your loans? How dare you? We're not going to give you any more money. The people, okay, so don't give us any more. But we're no longer going to have the euro. We're going to go back to our own currency. We're going to start fresh. And instead of giving you hundreds of billions of dollars, we're going to put that money back into social systems. So that's what we know is happening at this time. Everywhere you look in the world, where the Bilderberg Group, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, the individuals involved, I've given you their names and their positions, this is all a matter of history, and the media that they have so much influence over, which is most media, you'll see that globalization is the key. Open up your markets, break down your barriers, let us come in there and build our factories. We don't want to be in the United States anymore. So they take down the factories in the United States and they move them to other countries and cause massive unemployment. But they give us credit cards, so even when we're poor, we can buy things, create more debt. It's a non-sustainable environment. That's what they don't care. They care less about all this. They're all managing to stay in the loop. So the issue is the Bilderberg Group sustainable? Is it building a global government? John Ronson wrote an article for the Guardian paper in which he managed to interview key members of the Bilderberg Group for an expose on the organization, attempting to dismantle the conspiracy theories surrounding the secrecy of the meetings. However, through his interviews, important information regarding the social importance of the group continued to emerge. Ronson attempted to contact David Rockefeller, but only managed to reach his press secretary, who told Ronson that the conspiracy theories about Rockefeller and the global think tanks, such as Bilderberg in general, left David Rockefeller thoroughly fed up. According to his press secretary, Mr. Rockefeller's conclusion was that this was a battle between rational and irrational thought. Rational people favored globalization. Irrational people preferred nationalism. And while dismissing conspiracy theories that Bilderberg runs the world, Ronson did explain that the Bilderberg members he interviewed admitted that international affairs had, from time to time, been influenced by these sessions. As Dennis Healy, a 30-year member of the steering group of Bilderberg, himself pointedly explained, quote, "To say we are striving for a one-world government is exaggerated, but not wholly unfair. Those of us in Bilderberg felt we couldn't go on forever fighting one another for nothing and killing people and rendering millions homeless. So we felt that a single community throughout the world would be a good thing. Bilderberg is a way of bringing together politicians, industrialists, financiers, and journalists. Politics should involve people who aren't politicians. We make a point of getting along with younger politicians who are obviously rising to bring them together with financiers and industrialists who offer them wise words and increase the chance of having a sensible global policy," unquote. Will Hutton, the former editor of The Observer, who had been invited to Bilderberg meetings in the past, once famously referred to the group as, quote, "the high priests of globalization." Hutton has said that, quote, "people take part in these networks in order to influence the way the world works. The international common sense is what is needed," he said. G. William Domhoff is a professor of psychology and sociology at University of California, Santa Cruz, and he's written about the Bilderberg Group. In an interview, he discounted the notion that the study of such groups is relegated to the realm of conspiracy theory, and instead explained that he studies, quote, "how elites strive to develop consensus, which is through such publicly observable organizations as corporate boards and the policy planning network, which can be studied in detail and which are reported on in the media in at least a halfway accurate manner." Bilderbergers have long been advocates of global governance, and global government in crisis is always an excellent means through which to advance their agendas. Just as the Greek crisis has stepped up calls for the formation of European economic government, an idea which has been sought out much longer than Greece has been in crisis, so where does that bring us? That brings us back to where we began. David Rockefeller celebrated his 96th birthday last weekend, and before that he was at a Bilderberg meeting. And is one, if not the only, remaining original founders of the group in 1954. If the Bilderberg Group represents the high priests of globalization, then David Rockefeller is the Pope. James Wolfson represents the importance of the Rockefellers to not only America, but to the whole process of globalization. James Wolfson, an Australian national, was president of the World Bank until 2005 and has since founded and leads his private firm. And he's been on a long-time steering committee member of the Bilderberg Group. He also served as honorary trustee of the Brookings Institute. And he believes that what is happening is the right thing. My final thoughts on this. I believe that the Bilderbergs are not engaged in anything illegal. I believe that what the Bilderbergs are doing is that they are building a consensus among all of the important official players in the society. The educational institutions, the foundations, the think tanks on both left and right, then taking the top members of every possible important policy-making group, the people in the news media, in television and print and radio, those former legislators who are still respected, like a Bill Clinton, and financiers, major corporate leaders of the Fortune 500 company. And by getting them to agree that what is needed in the future is one currency, one world government, and one educational system, one set of standards, one set of laws, that we can then help, in their mind, help feed the poor and help control population. We can help people from going broke. That's their ideal. Now, maybe they really believe that. No one knows that for sure because no one's been in their head and they've never told us anything except what they're doing is for our good. Here's my concern. Who elected them to make decisions over how we should live? Look at the tools they've used. They've used the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, and in every single country these people have been in, there has been disaster for the average person, the working person, the poor person. The corporations that members sit on their board have devastated the environment. They built dams that weren't needed, roads that only served the people who owned the plantation. So if you've got a poor country and you build a road from the port where you're going to drive your trucks up to the plantation and then take the rubber or sugar, whatever you're doing as a cash crop, back to that ship to get it out, you're making the people pay for that road and pay for its upkeep, yet they got no benefit out of it. And this is what we see over and over and over again. Corruption is endemic. The support of corrupt rulers and countries that agree to go along with them is rampant. But we have not taken a look at that. That's too frightful of a picture. Instead, we will hear people like Bill Clinton and others will say, we need to help the poor, and globalization is a good way of doing it. And don't be protecting your own state or your country. That's protectionism, and that's isolationism, and that's foolish. That's not the future. So as long as we roll over and do exactly what they say, we're supposed to live a longer, healthier, and happier life. Our environment's supposed to be improved. The trouble is none of that is true. So on no other level than just pragmatic, look at the facts. Look at what you've created. They've created a global mess. Starvation, exploitation of natural resources, that's globalization. So where Bilderberg can continue holding its meetings in private, and at a certain level you're dealing with dysfunctional and insecure people who want to be invited into the club. Once they're inside the club, they feel so peacock happy that they've been invited to sit with the rich and powerful. Look at that person like Davos. Look at this person at this table. Look at this meeting. These are the richest, most powerful, Bill Gates, Warren Buffett. These are the top people. So I want to be here. Well, you have to give up on truth. I don't mind giving up on truth. You can't tell. You can't go right about it. I don't mind. You have to be a parrot. Whatever we tell you to say, you have to say it. Okay, what do I get in return? You get access to the club, the club of exclusives, the unique club. Isn't that why all rich people want to move immediately out of their neighborhood? No longer be around what was the familiar where they grew up? Don't they want to move to exclusive gated communities where people are just like them, rich and powerful, but never questioning how they made their money or how they got their power or the consequences? So we are surrounded in a culture of narcissism and greed and insecurity. It's not just the stupidity and the flagrant abuse of personal power by a wiener, the congressman, shows a bunch of women himself in his underpants. It's that need, the need to have power and then the need to hold it. The Bilderbergs, the Trilateral Commission, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Carnegie Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and all their elite groups, the Cato Institute, all of these institutions and groups, although legal, all are a home in my opinion, for sociopathic, very insecure, very disturbed people. Instead of going off to a Bilderberg group, why don't we send them off to a meditation group and let them come to grips with why they need to be in that powerful position to begin with. I'm Gary Nall. On my next program, I'll deal with the issues such as the New York Times favor and fear and the other topics I was not able to get to today. Thank you very much for listening. Have a nice day.